February 18th, 2015. I'm your host, John Lord. My guest this morning, Tom Parada, is a tennis columnist for the Wall Street Journal, who last week published an article about Jimmy Connors and Aaron Krikstein reuniting on the court for the first time since their epic five-set match at the 1991 U.S. Open. Tom, welcome to the View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
The Connors-Krikstein match in 91 is one of those moments where if you are of a certain age, it's one of those where-were-you-when moments, and I put it right up there along with, for me at least, in my childhood, the 86 World Series between the Mets and the Red Sox.
I have big memories of that one, too.
yeah, O.J. Simpson's car chase interrupting the NBA Finals. But this match gets put up right up there with some of my most vivid memories of sports when I was growing up. So can you tell us what you were doing on September 2nd, Labor Day, 1991?
Oh, for sure. My uncle has a beach house down in Charlestown, Rhode Island. I grew up in Rhode Island, and we were all down there for the Labor Day weekend, my entire family. I'm from a very big family. I have five brothers and sisters, and it's my parents and lots of cousins. And we were all there, and we were all watching that match on a little TV on that Monday. And if I recall correctly, and I'm pretty sure I do, everyone in my family was rooting for Jimmy Connors except me. I was 15. I played tennis, and you know, Aaron Krikstein was sort of the younger guy. He was, you know, had a cool look. He had a great forehand, and I, you know, Connors was always doing all sorts of things on court that drove people crazy. I wanted Krikstein to win really badly. I remember it was tough to watch him lose. As his father put it in that story, it was sort of like a bullfight, and he was the bull. It was something to see.
Yeah, it's truly remarkable. I think one of the most powerful aspects of your piece is that it conjures up so much nostalgia for us. And I can remember so vividly laying on my couch in my house on that nice lazy Labor Day afternoon and becoming so involved in the match. And I always had somewhat of an affinity for Connors, not necessarily because of his style of play, but because he's a week older than my dad. And I hope... One of the things that I thought was so cool about that 91 match and why I was pulling for Connors, was that, you know, he was a week older than my father, who I could only imagine how tired he would have been trying to complete a five-set match against a world-class player like Aaron Krikstein. So for me, it really resonated and it drove home this point of here you have this aging warrior kind of just rising from the tennis dead and putting forth one of the most spectacular efforts that we have ever seen in tennis. And I was not as well versed in tennis as you were, obviously, so I didn't really know much about Aaron Krikstein, but you, being someone who followed the sport even back then at the age of 15, you were well aware of who Aaron Krikstein was.
Yeah, well, I was. I mean, he was, you know, a favorite player than Agassi too. You know, you like the younger guys when you're a younger kid playing. That's generally the way it goes. Either that or the people who win all the time. And Connors wasn't that anymore. He, you know, barely even played in the year previous. And Krikstein had a really fun, powerful game. It was just one of those matches. Man, it's been watched more than any tennis match in history, I would guess. You can't quantify that, but I would imagine that just because of the rain delay reruns every year at the U.S. Open. I can't imagine, at least if you want to count it in pieces, little bits and pieces, that any match has been shown more.
I was going to ask you about that. I was very interested in that aspect of your article, and I wasn't sure if you could quantify it. I think we all feel, at least abstractly, that is true because of how often it is replayed during rain delays and how that there was that really poignant moment where I don't know where I read this. It might have been your piece or somewhere else in preparing for this podcast where, you know, Krikstein's father, you know, and people who are closest to him to this day still call him up when the match is being replayed during a rain delay and say, hey, you're on TV again.
And he gets that from just people on the street too.
Right. It made me wonder though, when you said that this is the most, rewatched match, or watched match in tennis history, could you even fathom a close second?
It's tough. I mean, Borg, McEnroe at Wimbledon, those two finals that they played two straight years, one a close one by Borg, and then finally McEnroe wins the next time. Those are really famous matches, and I've seen them replayed a few times, but nothing close to this. Now, maybe, at Wimbledon, that's a little different. Well, they don't really have rain delays much there anymore because they have a roof now. I've never heard anything get as much attention as this. And the thing that's amazing about it is it's not even a big – I mean, it's a big match culturally, but it's not a big match in the tournament. It was a fourth-round match. It's not the final. Neither guy goes on to win the tournament. Connors ends up winning another round and loses in straight sets in the semifinals. It's not even a huge match. It's a match that went beyond tennis because – of the age and the characters involved and all the stuff that went on off court and what it meant for a 39-year-old guy to make a run like this in a sport that was very much for the young. It's aged a little bit since then. You see a lot more older good players now, but nobody at 39, no, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to ask you is why this match still resonates with so many fans. I guess you have to be of a certain age to have this moment be as powerful as it is. But for us that remember watching it when it happened, it is still one of the most powerful moments of our sports fandom. And I wonder what it is exactly. You hit on a few things as far as
I think it could resonate with younger. Yeah, I think it could resonate with younger ages too. I'm sure.
Yeah.
If I show this match to my son in 5 or 6 or 7 years, that he'll think it's awesome too. It's an exhilarating match. There's a lot of good tennis in it. I think people forget that. There's one set where Krixie wins easily and Connors looks a little tired. Other than that, there's a lot of good tennis. There's a lot of different tactics. Connors is coming in all the time because he realizes he can't stay back and just hang out at the baseline with a kid who's a lot younger than him and is super steady. There's interesting tactics. The crowd is crazy. There's yelling at the umpire. It's tense. And then he's down 5-2 in the last set and makes yet another comeback. And then a tiebreaker adds a lot of tension. U.S. Open was the only place they play the fifth set tiebreaker. That adds a lot of tension too. It's got a lot of elements. The best tennis matches to me have elements beyond just the tennis itself, sort of like the 2008 Wimbledon final between Federer and Nadal, which is, the best match I've ever seen live. It's two great players, two all-time great players playing against each other, and that's enough. But there's also rain delays, and it's almost dark, and they're not sure if they're going to finish, and it's the guy who hasn't won winning after blowing a two-set lead. There's all sorts of other variables, and that's what makes a good tennis match, drama plus the tennis.
Yeah, and at the time, and we're talking with Tom Perrotta of the Wall Street Journal, at the time in 1991, for me at least, it was such a contrast in style and personality, and I didn't know as much about Jimmy Connors and Eric Krixie, their history, but, just on the surface, from looking at them cosmetically and their age difference, Jimmy Connors struck me in that moment as kind of the venerable, wise veteran. And you look across the net at Aaron Krixie and he's this young, punkish, wearing a headband, upstart. But the more you research that match and the more you learn about these two guys, these two characters, it was actually the opposite. And Krixie is really an old soul, whereas Connors is kind of this the young at heart whippersnapper, kind of the rabble rouser that he was.
Yeah, Jimmy's always anti-establishment and still was to that day, and Krixie and to this day still is a very quiet, unassuming, nice, calm guy. I mean, totally pleasant person and quite funny and a good time to be around. But he's a little more shy, and he's not the sort of person who's just gonna go crazy on an umpire. And he, that one controversial call in the second set of that match where he says, that ball was out, and then it does get overruled and Connors goes crazy. That's about as agitated as you ever saw him get in his entire career. And it doesn't even count as agitated. I mean, it's very, it's very little in Keeled. And I think that some other unfair things sort of came out of that match. I mean, I think people came away from that match thinking, oh, well, this guy's a choker. And if I'm not mistaken, he's either tied or has the most come from behind down two sets to love victories of anybody in tennis ever. Krixie.
Aaron Krixie does.
Yeah. He was the leading player. I don't know if somebody tied him or beat him since then, but he's up there. It's like 10 or 11, something crazy. He beat Stefan Edberg after down two sets at the Australian Open in 1995. Guy's not a choker. He was good in big matches and good against big players. He really liked those moments, and he was a very steady player. Really didn't make mistakes, wouldn't beat himself. And that's the sort of player who can really drive anybody nuts. But Connors is the one guy who really made him nervous, because they had a relationship, and, you know, they were practice partners and they were friends, and Jimmy was this legend. And something I didn't get into that story, which is a great anecdote, you know, I was originally going to get in there, and we were a little tighter on space, and that's sometimes funny things just go by the wayside, is the first time they played, you know, Connors beat him 0-0 when Kriegstein was 16, and that really starts things off. But he flew into that match on a helicopter 5 minutes before it started.
Who's that? Connors. Who did? Jimmy Connors did?
Connors did. Yeah. So, you know, here you are, this 16-year-old kid, and your opponent is this legend, and he flies in a helicopter 5 years.
Yeah.
That's how you're supposed to play a guy like that. And, you know, he totally froze up. So, I mean, he's really come a long way since that day. And you know, and on and on and on. And they did play one more time. I think people forget that too. And Kriegstein was ahead in that match and lost. That was about 5 months later.
Yeah, I in researching this podcast, I revisited the This Is What They Want documentary on ESPN, and I found that there were a lot of interesting aspects of the match that I didn't know beforehand. One of them was that this friendship that Kriegstein and Connors did have, and what was strange about this friendship between Kriegstein and Connors prior to their match in 91 in the US Open was that Connors really wasn't friendly with anyone on tour. In fact, that is what kind of fueled the fire, so to speak, is that, you know, he had a difficult time befriending other players on tour, because his motivation was to treat the other players like enemies. But
I don't even think it was a difficult time. I think it was a choice. I think it was, I'm not out here to make friends. I'm out here to win tennis matches, which, you know, some players operate that way. He's an incredibly competitive guy.
But that friendship.
With Aaron, yeah, it was different. They shared an agent. And I think also it helped that he was much, much younger and Jimmy was much, much older. I don't think there was a sense of that this kid's really that threatening to me. And then by the time he's in his mid-30s, it's like, you know, what else? It's a different feel. You know, it's not someone his same age. It's more of like a father-son, mentor-student type relationship. So I think that sort of worked.
But that friendship, the friendship backfired for Kriegstein. I think one of the things that is revealed in learning more about this match is that I think Kriegstein, because of their friendship, thought that Connors might be behaving differently than he does in every other match, and that just wasn't the case. So I don't know if you can say that Jimmy Connors took advantage of their friendship in that moment, but I think when you rewatch that match, there almost seems to be this aura of disappointment that surrounds Kriegstein, not just in the tennis, but in, hey, how is my friend doing this to me? How is he riling up the crowd the way he is and you know, showing me up with the umpire and things like that?
It's tricky. I have a little different read on it, but I think those are good points. I don't see...
Oh, what's Connors your reason?
I don't see Connors as having taken advantage of the friendship at all. I mean, I think the thing about Jimmy, and I think Aaron knew this to that day and definitely knows it now, is that he's going to do whatever it takes to win. And when he gets on the court, he's not going to be your friend. And I think Aaron understood that. I just think he was not capable of functioning that same way, that it was hard for him to play against a friend, even though he didn't want it to be difficult. And then when it starts happening and it starts snowballing and it's going crazy, I think some of the disappointment you see on his face is more in himself, that, you know, why am I not doing the best that I can out here? Why am I not handling this as best as I can? Because I know I can, you know, I've been ahead in this match. I could win this match. I think it's more a fight with himself, which is a bad place to be on a tennis court. You're already fighting somebody else. You don't want to fight yourself too.
One more opponent to have to conquer.
Right. The toughest one. That opponent never goes away.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things that has come up for me is that, and you mentioned this earlier, is that in 1991 at the U.S. Open, that the path for each of these players to get to the fourth round was difficult. And I mentioned this documentary, This Is What They Want. I watched that recently. Yeah. What's that?
There's a lot of great stuff in that.
Yeah. There's a lot of great stuff there. And one of the things that I found most fascinating was that each player had to defeat a first round opponent that is pretty well-known opponent. Kriegstein defeated Andre Agassi in the first round of the 1991 U.S. Open, and then Jimmy Connors in what is not a less talked about match, yet perhaps equally as contentious and enthralling as the Christine Connors match, Jimmy Connors came back to defeat Patrick McEnroe in five sets, and I had no idea that that match even occurred.
Oh, that match was an amazing match, yeah, and it does get sort of swept aside a little bit because of what happened afterward, and that the Crixie match was on Connors' birthday. That's another element to that match, and on Labor Day, and everybody saw it, and there was momentum, but he, you know, he never should have got. It's amazing that he got to the quarterfinals, like, you know, to the fourth round and whatever else, like he did. It was, you know, it's impossible to think that he would. He was down two sets to Patrick McEnroe, another incredibly steady player. I mean, Patrick was always really good at not beating himself and had a fantastic backhand. You know, a very good player. I think people, you know, forget, you know, because John was this legend, his brother, that, you know, how good of a player Patrick was, and not the sort of player who's going to blow a lead. And, you know, little things happened in that match too, and then the crowd got into it, and it got really late, and the crowd, what was left of them, came down closer to the court and made a ton of noise, and all of a sudden, you're in a fight. And, you know, Jimmy's really good that way, and that just energized him for the whole tournament.
Yeah, there was that moment in watching that documentary on ESPN. There was that moment in that Connors-Patrick McEnroe match from the first round of the 1991 U.S. Open where I believe a controversial call went against Jimmy Connors, and I think he was down two sets and maybe even a break in the third set to McEnroe.
And he was down two in a break, yeah.
Yeah, and he just starts staring at the umpire, grandstanding, as the crowd is just in absolute rapture at supporting Jimmy Connors while Patrick McEnroe might even be waiting to serve. And you have this kid from Queens waiting to serve while Jimmy Connors has the entire arena up on their feet chanting against the umpire and poor Patrick McEnroe. At that point, it's impossible to believe this, but you watch the video and Patrick McEnroe doesn't have a chance anymore in that match.
Yeah. And I don't envy Patrick McEnroe. I would not want to be in that position against Mike Connors, because the only thing you're thinking is, I'm so close. I just have to hold serve, and this match is over. I've got this guy. He really wasn't showing much life. He didn't really have any reason to believe. He hadn't played much last year. He was 38, going on 39 in another week. That the match is there for the taking, and then something like that happens, and it gives the guy a spark, and you get a little bit tight, and then all of a sudden it's a big problem. Then it goes on for hours and hours and hours, and people are screaming like they want your blood, like you're the one who did something terrible to Jimmy Connors, which is, you know, not the case at all. I mean, he's a local kid, for God's sakes. He was not an unpopular player at the U.S. Open.
And as you mentioned earlier, the match between Connors and Crickstein in 91 was just a fourth-round match, although the amount of times it's shown on television, you'd be led to believe that it was the finals. Connors went on to win another round, then lost to Courier in the semis. Let's transition to kind of the focus of your piece in the Wall Street Journal last week, which is this reunion that took place in Boca Raton, Florida, between Connors and Crickstein. Do you have any reason why, or were you given any reason why these two players didn't talk until they set up this match?
You know, I think a lot of people didn't really know that, actually, until that documentary came out. And I think, you know, some of the sense that people got was that, oh, you know, that this match sort of ruined their friendship and they hate each other. I don't really, you know, having spoken to both of them, especially having spoken to Aaron a lot, I don't think that that's the case. I think it's a matter of, I take Aaron at his word. I think he's a very straight shooter, and, you know, you need some space after a match like that. It was really tough. I think he definitely felt like Jimmy crossed a few lines, you know, with the amount of tirades and whatever else, but nothing that I don't think he blamed that for why he lost. You need a little space, and you play another match, you don't really talk then, and then all of a sudden one guy's off the tour, and you go on. Five, you know, two, three, 4 years go by, and then why do you decide to pick up the phone at that point? You need a reason, right? You don't just sort of randomly, after 6 years, say, I'm going to call. And I think all of a sudden 10, 15, 20 years go by, and they haven't run into each other and whatever else, which is odd. Christian into each other at the U.S. Open. I think it was around 2004-ish or something, where he saw Jimmy in the player area, but then another player came out and was talking to Aaron for a few minutes, and when he looked over, Jimmy was gone. But he thought that they were actually going to shake hands and say hello there, you know, sort of break the ice, but it just didn't happen. But at the same time, he was very nervous about calling him, because he really never knew, you know, what did Jimmy think about
all this and think about that match. But I think if you know Connors a little bit, he doesn't really hold that stuff inside. I mean, it's on the court for him, and then he's on to his next thing. So I'm not surprised that Connors was receptive when he called and that they started getting along right away and did this match. I thought it was pretty noble. You know, Jimmy's gotten a lot of attention over the years for being difficult and his personality on court and all that stuff. I thought this was a pretty noble thing for him to do. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, Christine's throwing him a few bucks to come down and do this exhibition, which, you know, he does for everybody, but it's very small amount. He doesn't really have to do this. You know, you're going to lose pretty much. I mean, he's 62 years old.
He's got three hip replacements.
Yeah. Right. But he clearly comes down there in pretty good shape. When the ball's in his wheelhouse, Jimmy Connors still hits a great ball. It was actually really fun to see. They had some rallies that were 20, 25, 30 shots. You know, the crowd really liked it. And, to do that and come down and, you know, and take a loss, and it's good closure on this event. It's nice publicity for Crixie and his club, and you get back together with your friend. And I thought it was a pretty sweet thing for him to do. And it was a really fun event. I thought it could be fun. I went down there not sure what to expect, and it was 10 to 20 times better than I thought it would have been. It was really a great afternoon.
Was the impetus for Crickstein in kind of organizing this reunion, was the impetus closure? Did he feel as if he needed some personal closure?
I think he thought, you know, enough is enough. I mean, let's just do this. This is a fun way to do this. And we used to get along well. I like this guy. Let's not be not in touch for the rest of our lives. What's the point in that? Very grown up, normal reason to do something like this. I think that was enough to finally sort of be motivated to do it.
I'm actually surprised that someone hasn't tried to capitalize on this match before. I wonder if Crickstein and Connors have rejected overtures from other tournament organizers to recreate this match.
It's a good question. You know, honestly, I now feel sort of like I neglected one ask because by not asking that, neither one of them told me about that. That's for sure. And I think, you know, the only people who had mentioned it to Aaron in the past were the people at his club who were like, you know, it would be cool if you could get Jimmy to come here, because he gets a different, you know, former star to come every year and they play an exhibition. He's had Lendl, he's had Roddick, he's had Philippoussis, he's had Jimmy Arias. I think he had Courier 1 year. All sorts of different people. And so they wanted him to do it, and he kept saying, you know, no, it's not going to happen. I don't feel comfortable. And finally, he said, you know what? I'm ready for this. Let's give it a try. But that's the only other suggestion of it that I've heard. Honestly, when I was told about this, I was at the Australian Open, and I got an email from a PR person who was working with them on this, saying that this was going to happen in February, and was I interested in coming down? And I mean, I responded within minutes because I was very interested, but I wrote back saying, you have to prove to me that this isn't a joke. Because I thought it was a hoax for sure. I said, you gotta be kidding me. What is this? I've never, how could it be? And they're like, no, it's real. It's real. And here's Aaron's email, and email him yourself. Here's his phone number, and you know, you check on it and then get back to us. And, you know, and I did, and it was fine, but it seemed like such an amazing idea and a cool idea to me that I thought, this, someone's playing games with me. This is not realistic.
And for me, it leaves me wondering whether or not the door is now open for these two to return to the court in some other arena, perhaps Arthur Ashe Stadium. I wonder if, I know Jimmy Connors has come out and said, and in your article you report that he says that this is his last public match, but knowing Connors the way we do as far as his personality and his competitive fire, I find that hard to believe.
Well, there's a couple of things in there, and one is, yeah, there's that. There's also, you know, if someone's going to say to you, which this isn't going to happen because the market, I don't think, bears it. But if someone says, oh, here's $2 or $3 million, you know, to go play this again. Well, that's tough to turn down, right, for anybody. But if you look at Jimmy over the years, when he makes a statement like that and he's adamant about it, he generally sticks to it. He's always said that this match, this 11 days at the U.S. Open was the greatest of his career. And that's a lot. The guy won 8 Grand Slam titles and, you know, over 1,000 matches and tons of tournaments. And for him to say that that's the best 11 days of his tennis career, even though he didn't win anything, is amazing. And he said that for years and he's stuck to it. And he said this match with Crickstein was the toughest, you know, match, beat him up more than any other match he's ever played. And he stuck to that too. I think if he's going to be that adamant about saying, this is it, this is how I want to go out, this is my last thing, that just as a point of pride and saying, I told you so, and I'm sticking to it, that it really might be
his last thing. I won't be surprised if you don't see him playing any public tennis again. If, you know, I guess it could happen, but he seemed pretty convinced of it at the time. And the main reason being, it's pretty hard for him to get satisfaction out of hitting the ball anymore, which I think is a big thing for anybody who used to play at that level. And it's painful, and his hips bother him, and he can't move, and he loves to move and hit the ball on the run, and that's really sort of what he enjoyed more than anything. And I think the stuff that he really likes about tennis, it's only there for a minute or two, and then otherwise it's just suffering. That's not really a lot of fun for him.
Last question on this particular article, and this is really a tough one for anyone to answer, and it's a
I'll sure hypothetical. No.
Pass before you hear it. Okay. This is just a sheer hypothetical, but do you feel in talking with Krikstein and talking with Connors that there's this still lingering sense that their careers, that their lives would have been inextricably different had the match gone the other way?
Well, if the match had, for sure, in some ways, I don't know. Well, Connors' career would not have been any different. I mean, you wouldn't have this, you would still have a pretty nice run at the U.S. Open for someone who's 39, fourth round ain't half bad, especially if he loses in five sets. It's kind of interesting, you know, but it wouldn't have been, this really capped it off for him as like the ultimate American tennis war, which I don't know that it quite would have, he might have deserved it anyway, but I don't know that it would have been quite as definitive. But, you know, he still won all the titles and he'd been number one for all those weeks and won all those tournaments. So, you know, you can't take that away from him. He could have never played this U.S. Open and he still would have had all that. And for Krikstein, he would not be nearly as famous had he won this match. And he admits that readily and laughs at
me. Told me that's fascinating.
Yeah, if I had won that match, there wouldn't be replayed every year. No one would talk about it. And, you know, he's now at a point in his life where I think he appreciates that he's part of tennis history, as painful as it was at the time and for the months and whatever that followed to have to deal with that loss. I think, you know, he's grown up now and he's got kids. I think it's at least somewhat satisfying. Like, you know what? I was, you know, a good enough player and people thought well enough of me that I was part of this historic match and, you know, did what best I could on that day. And we turned in a performance together that, you know, nobody's ever going to forget. So yeah, that wouldn't be the case if he had won because he was oddly expected to win, even though he had never beaten Connors before. At that point, he was 0-5 against him in his career. But being so much younger and Jimmy being so, you know, so not even thought about when the tournament started, he was still not expected to beat Krikstein.
But hindsight being 20/20 and it's you know, it's easy to say that he's at a place in his life where he's quite content with his career. But if you look back on that match, if Krikstein say defeats Connors in an epic five set match, who knows what he goes on to do in that U.S. Open. And then, you know, there's some heartbreaking stuff that happened after that match for Krikstein. You know, he lost his coach. I don't know if his coach left him, you know, right after the U.S. Open or a couple tournaments later.
I think it was pretty closely thereafter, right? And he went on to coach Pete Sampras.
He went on to coach Pete Sampras. And you're just left to wonder, you know, if, you know, Aaron Krikstein would have had a much more prolific tennis career had he won that match. I think your point is very interesting about, you know, he's now a part of eternal tennis lore because of being a part of this match. But you do wonder if he would have experienced more success as a tennis player had he won.
I used to wonder that same thing, and I used to wonder it a lot. And then after having spent a bunch of time with him in Florida and talked with him beforehand on the phone, I really don't wonder that anymore. And it's a good thing because he doesn't really wonder it, and I think he's right not to. I think he did the best he could in his career. I think he had a bunch of bad luck with injuries. He had a lot of problems with his feet and other stuff. You know, if he had won that match, he had never lost to Haro's before, so let's say he wins that one. And he gets to the semis. Then he's playing Currier. Currier was playing really well that year. Jim Currier was a really good player. And, you know, at that time, I mean, he ended up losing that final to Edberg. But, you know, he's a phenomenal player, and he took Connors apart. That's, at best, 50-50 for Krikstein and probably less. Probably, say, 60-40 Currier. Currier was playing really well. So if he loses that tournament in the semifinals, is that suddenly going to make his career – to a complete, 180. I don't know. I mean, he did well after that. He got back up to the top 15. He made the semifinals of the 90. five Australian Open, and that really hurt him because he got hurt in that match. He had to retire. I think it was in the fifth set against Agassi of the 95 Australian Open, and I think he was really in a good place then and felt like he could make a good push. And injuries, I think, were more of a problem for him later on. Mentally, to me, he got over that match and played some really good tennis for the next at different stretches in the next 3 or 4 years, and that, to me, shows that that match didn't kill him. If he never won again after that match and sort of went to a funk and was off the tour for a year and, you know, had all sorts of problems, then I'd say, yeah, that's a different story, but that's not really how it went for him.
Yeah, and just to crystallize the transcendent power of this match in the 1991 U.S. Open, all of the major magazines and newspapers the week after the U.S. Open final had pictures of Jimmy Connors, not Stefan Edberg.
Yeah, it just, sure.
It just tells you everything you need to know about how the general public was so involved with this match between Jimmy Connors and Aaron Kirkstein. And Tom Prada, before I let you go here, I did want to ask you a few things about tennis today.
Oh, sure.
Are there any stories that you are pursuing, following in tennis this year that you care to share with us?
Oh, you know, there's always tons of stuff we're doing. I mean, I'm paying a lot of attention to Serena Williams this year, as I think a lot of people are. She just won her 19th major title at the Australian Open. It's going to be really tough for her to catch Steffi Graf's open era record of 22. I think tougher than maybe people think. You know, if you look back over the last few years, she's only won one or two majors a year for the last few years at most. And she's also had some injury problems, and she's going to be 34 years old in September. But she's so amazing that it's possible. And she seems to be motivated and in a good place. And she's also going to be playing Indian Wells for the first time since a terrible incident there. You know, with her and her sister. I'm not sure if her sister's going to be playing. There's no word on that yet, but it's good. She's going to be back there. Be a pretty moving thing for the sport. And
when you say treatment, are you referring to the fact that the fans were openly against Serena and Venus?
Yeah, yes, and her father, just some racist comments from the stands and Venus too, and they haven't played there since then. It's a really very, you know, just a very low point for the sport, bad moment for the sport, very tough moment for them. I can understand entirely why they haven't played, but it's great to see her coming back there and tying it to a charity too. She's doing some work related to that and promoting it in that way. And I think it's going to be amazing to see her on the court there. And it's good for the sport and for things beyond the sport too. So we'll see how she does there, and then it's off to the, you know, clay court season and the French Open, which is she's been quite good at, but it's tough. And Wimbledon, you know, she hasn't won Wimbledon in a little while, which I think annoys her a little bit because she's been so good there. I think it was 2012, I guess, the last time she won. So that'll be a big tournament for her too. And you know, she'd need to win the next three to tie Graf this year. I think that's asking way too much. I think even for her, that's way too much to see her win in a calendar Grand Slam at age 33. But
it sounds like the way you're talking, it sounds like she sees that the end is in sight.
I think she thinks it's possible. I mean, she thinks anything's possible. She's that sort of person. And I think it's possible too. It's just a matter of her staying healthy, which is, you know, not always in your control. You can work out and you can do whatever you can to stay healthy, but, you know, a lot of health is luck when you're putting that much strain on your body all the time.
Can you give me a player in both the men's and women's tennis outside of the top 10 who you would be surprised if they won a major championship this year?
Outside the top 10 that I would not be surprised?
Yeah.
Hmm.
How about outside the top 5? Is the 10 too much of a stretch?
No, 10 is maybe a little bit of a stretch, though. Okay. I don't know where Grigor Dimitrov is ranked. Right now, is he top 10 right now? I don't know if his ranking dropped. How far it dropped after? I'd have to look. How far it dropped after Australia and his and recent tournament that he had. But he's, you know, he can do great things. That guy, and he's been on the verge for a long time. So it's possible, but I would say unlikely for the men. Women, I'd say unlikely too. But there's a lot of good players coming up in women's tennis. I think it's a really exciting time the next few years for women's tennis, which is also why it's going to be hard for Serena to do. To win so many more majors. There's just a lot of, from Jeannie Bouchard from Canada, Garbiñe Muguruza from Spain, Simona Halep is playing really great. There's lots of people coming up who are very talented and they have different styles, do different things, and it's a lot of fun to see.
And some pretty good young American women players too.
Yeah, very good. Madison Keys really shot up to the top of that list for her performance in Australia. She's really has a lot going for her. Great personality, very competitive, very fun, fantastic serve, really good forehand. Just hits the ball big from everywhere. And she's only 19 years old. I mean, I think people need to give her a little space and a little time and remember that. 19 is incredibly young, especially for tennis these days where the players are definitely winning at a little bit older ages. It takes a little bit more strength and physical conditioning than, you know, most teenagers are sort of capable of doing. So at 19, she has a lot of time. I wouldn't expect her to win a Grand Slam title this year, but if she stays healthy, I'll be really, really surprised if she doesn't win one someday.
Well, Tom Parada, the Wall Street Journal tennis columnist, thank you for taking the time to talk about Connors and Kriegstein. It was fun to relive those memories.
That was great. Thanks for having me.